Chapter 13. Approach. A dramatic change occurred at the Gorman Ranch in the fall of 1996. The hunter became the hunted. The phenomenon was suddenly confronted not with a family, but with a scientific team whose primary motivation was not fear, but curiosity. This was a significant turn of events for something, whatever it was, that had, for all intents and purposes, been in charge for several years. Now, it was no longer in charge. But how exactly would the scientific team carry out this highly unusual research? There were two sides to the issue. One camp argued for full instrumentation and to cover every square yard of the property with automated sensors that would constantly feed back data. The other camp argued that less is more, that too much equipment, too much activity might even be detrimental. That was Tom Gorman's point of view. Tom believed that too much activity and technology was guaranteed to drive the phenomenon into hiding. He thought the NIDS group should set up a command post in nearby Roosevelt or Vernal and silently and surreptitiously creep onto the property at night while disturbing as few geographical landmarks as possible. "This phenomenon needs to be hunted like a wild animal," he told me on numerous occasions, "maybe even a very smart, big game animal." Tom also recommended a stealth method for obtaining video footage of the mysterious flying activity that haunted the ranch. He used to sneak out of his house after dark, armed with an old manual video recorder that contained as few electronics as possible. Slowly and painstakingly, often on his stomach, he would make his way down to a vantage point where the weird floating lights were often seen. That spot was about 2/3 of a mile west of his house. Like an expert hunter, he would wriggle along the ground while taking care not to break any branches or twigs, and he would remain in the same place for 20 minutes if he thought he had made the slightest noise. Sometimes he would take hours to arrive at a good location where he could observe and listen. Tom told me he had lain almost frozen in ditches for hours while he waited to catch a few minutes of activity on videotape. Though only marginally successful, he did see numerous quietly floating lights of all shapes and sizes during these nightly forays. Tom assured me his methods were successful and had produced results, and this proved to him that whatever was terrorizing him was not necessarily omnipotent. Or maybe it was just playing with him. Maybe it could see him perfectly and was just reeling him in like a fish. Tom said he never really knew. Whether to deploy more or less equipment and personnel was a hotly discussed issue within NIDS. There was little precedent on which to base our decision. Some members of the team researched the two best-known areas where scientific equipment had been deployed to study strange phenomena: Project Hessdalen in Norway and Gulf Breeze in Florida. The Hessdalen Valley lies in central Norway and has been the site of numerous unexplained lights for decades. In 1984, engineer Arling Strand and others carried out a 36-day instrument coverage of the area. A magnetometer, a radio spectrum analyzer, a seismograph, cameras, some with dispersion gratings, a Geiger counter, an infrared viewer, and a laser were deployed in the area for about 7 weeks as a pilot experiment. This short experiment established that the Hessdalen phenomenon was measurable. The major finding was a correlation between the appearance of luminous phenomena and magnetic perturbations. Attempts at obtaining line spectra through diffraction grating analysis were unsuccessful, although 53 visually witnessed occurrences of unexplained lights happened and a few photographs were taken. This initial success was then translated into an expanded and automated set of measurement protocols. In the 1990s, under the guidance of Arling Strand and Bjørn Jetle Hogje, who by then were assistant professors at Østfold College in Sarpsborg, a real-time automated observatory, dubbed the Automated Measurement Station, AMS, was designed and built. Beginning in 1998, the AMS was deployed in the Hessdalen Valley. The AMS was equipped with automatic wide-angle and zoom video cameras able to monitor the phenomenon in real time, as well as a radar transponder and a magnetometer. During 5 years of operation, the AMS recorded an extremely valuable statistical variation of the lights, and it indicated that the lights were not from any mundane, man-made source. Early on, there were indications of correlations among sunspot activity, geomagnetic storms, and the appearance of the lights, although subsequent, more intensive analysis ruled out that correlation. The phenomenon was recorded more often in winter and between the hours of 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. However, the study author noted, these statistics did not lead to an understanding of the origin or nature of the phenomenon. Project EMBLA, Electromagnetic Behavior of Luminous Anomalies, followed. EMBLA was a joint mission of Italian radio astronomy groups, the Italian National Research Council, and the Norwegian team. The aim was to expand the instrumentation, and three missions were deployed to the Hestdalen Valley. Thus, in August 2000, the Norwegian AMS station in Hestdalen was equipped with an additional set of automated instruments from the Italian group. These included a VLF-ELF, very low frequency, extremely low frequency, correlation receiver, and spectrometer. The VLF Inspire receiver, two spectrometers, Sentinel-1 and Sentinel-2, both centered at 1,420 MHz. This frequency is used in astrophysical and SETI studies, and a wideband antenna connected to a spectrum analyzer. All instruments in the Italian package were computer-controlled. Data was recorded continuously and automatically and stored on CD-ROMs. The global picture of the phenomenon obtained so far, the Norwegian-Italian collaborative project concluded, shows that the phenomenon's radiant power varies, reaching values up to 19 kilowatts. These changes are caused by the sudden surface variations of the illuminated area owing to the appearance of clusters of light balls that behave in a thermally self-regulated way. Apparent characteristics consistent with a solid are strongly suspected from the study of distributions of radiant power. Other anomalous characteristics include the capability to eject smaller light balls, some unidentified frequency shift in VLF change, and possible deposition of metallic particles. But the bottom line of Project EMBLA was the same. A self-consistent, definitive theory of the phenomenon's nature and origin in all its aspects cannot be constructed yet quantitatively, but some of the observations can be explained by an electrochemical model for the ball lightning phenomenon. A rough, albeit less elegantly phrased, translation of the above statement could be, "We don't know what the hell is going on." As the chief field research scientist at NIDS, members of the esteemed science advisory board were usually not part of the field research teams, although they participated on occasion. I and others spent hours discussing the Hestdalen project with Erling Strand and his group. What emerged is glaringly absent from the scientific discussion of the Hestdalen instrumentation packages and research program. When I asked him, "What do the local residents of the Hestdalen Valley experience?" Erling answered that there were multiple reports of bizarre encounters with UFOs and reports of abductions and other odd events had been commonplace in the valley for decades. The engineers in the AMS project had little motivation or interest in pursuing this angle. They focused, quite rightly, on perfecting the ability to measure these phenomena, not delving into the phenomenology and sociology of the reports. But I wonder if the locals might not have provided the group with fresh insight into what was going on in the valley. There was obviously an unbridgeable gulf separating the engineers and their instrumentation from the soft, squishy stories with no physical evidence of abductions, huge triangular craft, UFO lore, strange creatures, etc. In August 2004, Project Hestdalen was suspended due to financial difficulties. Gulf Breeze is the other hot spot that received scientific attention for a brief period of time. An unprecedented series of sightings took place in this town on the Florida Panhandle between November 1990 and July 1992. During that time, reported physicist Bruce McAbee, the Gulf Breeze research team, GBRT, logged about 170 sightings, most of which involved multiple witnesses and most of which included still photography with telephoto lenses and or recording by video cameras. In several cases, a light was observed simultaneously by two separated groups of people, thereby allowing for triangulation. In one case, infrared-sensitive film detected a change in the output radiation from a light, and in another case, a diffraction grating was used to obtain a spectrum of a Bubba UFO. The unknown flying thing got its name when the skywatchers in Gulf Breeze kept shouting, "Look over there, Bubba!" And also the spectrum of a red road flare. the spectra were found to be different. The sightings at Gulf Breeze continued for a few months and provoked enough interest that a UFO detection van was assembled in Canada and the United States by a private engineering firm. The van rolled into Gulf Breeze, and a few nights later, the activity stopped. Only a couple of anomalous magnetic field measurements were made before the UFO activity terminated. The attempt to instrument the area was eventually aborted because of a lack of activity. The full impact of these studies would elude us for several years. In early September 1996, the NIDS team, which was then composed of a physicist, a veterinarian, both of whom do not want their names revealed, and myself, moved into an observation trailer that had been rapidly deployed on the property. We had begun to execute our plan, against Tom's better judgment. Our aim was to gather data in the electromagnetic and magnetic regions, as well as a visible UV spectrum of any UFO lights. To accomplish this, over the course of the next few months, we assembled a light-gathering device with a Fresnel lens. This large-diameter lens was designed to focus light onto an optic fiber, which in turn fed directly into a portable handheld spectrometer purchased from Ocean Optics. The spectrometer was literally palm-sized and was linked to a laptop computer. This immensely portable station was ideal for investigating different areas of the ranch and was used to gather real-time spectra in UV and visible ranges. The spectra were then stored on the laptop to be analyzed as needed. In addition to this, the team had a very portable assortment of night vision binoculars, video cameras with night vision attachments, radio frequency analyzers, microwave detectors, etc. We also hired a couple of additional investigators. In the early phase of the NIDS project, two teams were deployed on the property every night. The teams communicated with Motorola walkie-talkies. Each team had at least one scientist and one or two investigators. The team's mandate was to capture evidence of any unusual events on videotape and cameras. This way, the data, if any, could be impartially scrutinized and critiqued by the 15-member Science Advisory Board. During this initial startup phase, the advisory board regularly flew into Las Vegas for intensive two-day briefings by the scientific field staff. On September 16, 1996, at about 1:30 a.m., the team had moved into the observation trailer to take a break. When out of the window, somebody spotted a light over the cottonwood trees at the west end of the ranch. I was there with Tom and two scientists. The light was so bright that we at first thought it might be a flare. It hovered for about 10 minutes above the distant tree line, moved down out of sight, and then back up. We all agreed that the behavior and the appearance of the light were unlike any aircraft, helicopter, flare, star, or planet. In short, the object was unidentified. Cameras, night vision devices, and digital video images did little to resolve the distant light. We took several photos that showed nothing but a tiny distant light. Nevertheless, the appearance of this distant object was cause for excitement among the science crew. Though it was a good distance away, it was definitely unidentified, and it was a tiny, first step on the road to confirming what Tom had been seeing. But we agreed that the sighting, although unexplained, was also profoundly mundane. It did not really qualify as an independent validation of Tom's observations as defined by the NIDS plan. The sighting did serve as an excellent morale booster, however, and the night watches were redoubled. We felt we were ready for anything.